Welcome to the Wealth Studying Podcast. This is episode 68. It's January 5th, 2015. I'm your host, John Pugliano. I'm also the founder and money manager at investablewealth.com. Here at the Wealth Studying Podcast, my goal is to teach you 10 wealth building principles to help you not only build your net worth, but more importantly, to attain personal freedom. I like to say that money may not buy happiness, but it can buy freedom. If you're not familiar with my wealth building principles or you're new to the show, go back and listen to the first 10 episodes. That's where I build the foundation and I lay out my philosophy on building wealth. You won't hear any get-rich-quick schemes. My theories are based on hard work and discipline. So if you're looking for an easy way out, you probably don't want to listen to this podcast. But if you're serious about building your wealth and you want to take control of your own personal freedom and liberty, then you've come to the right place. The markets have been trading down the last four trading sessions. There was a lot of volatility, especially today. We saw the markets drop nearly 2%. So today's episode will be focused on the markets. I'll be providing you with my observations and commentary, and I'll tell you the things that I'm going to be watching in the coming days and weeks. Today's plunge shouldn't have come as a surprise to any of you wealthsteaders. In my opinion, we've been in a market correction since about December 12th, and that's despite the fact that we did see a Santa Claus rally, and we saw the markets making new all-time highs. There's still been a lot of volatility. We've seen distribution days numbering probably 7 or 8 distribution days. And those are periods of extremely high volatility where we see a lot of selling taking place in above average volume. And we see that in a relatively short period of time, about 4 to 5 weeks. So that's why personally, I took my profits around mid-December. I've been keeping my powder dry. I'm building my watch list and I'm waiting for the next opportunity. I have absolutely no idea if this current downtrend is going to materialize into a big correction or not. The important thing for you to remember is that not only do I not have any idea, neither do you and neither does anybody else. That's why we take the markets a day at a time, and that's why we're reactionary, we're not dogmatic. We don't hold to any one forecast or to any particular ideology. We know that markets fluctuate, and although we may be able to foresee some long-term trends, we know that in the short term, the markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. So we don't try and be the smartest man in the room. We don't try and overthink or outthink the markets. I follow some simple strategies of looking at long and short-term trends, which are mostly demographic in nature, and by that I mean people-oriented. You see, I believe that the market is a big live organism. It's literally the result of the interactions of billions and billions of people throughout this world. And so I think market fluctuations are based a lot more on human nature than they are in the laws of economics. But in addition to those long and short-term trends, which again are mostly driven by people, by demographics, I'm looking at the day-to-day chart actions of what the market is telling us. Where's the market in relation to its moving averages? What's the trade level? And by that I mean, are more or less shares trading hands? That's what's important to me. So long and short-term trends and the interactions of people. So where do we stand today? Well, right now, the U.S. consumer is very optimistic. They're seeing low energy costs, which means more money in their wallet. And we know about the American consumer. The more money they have in their wallet, the more they spend. I don't know about you, but the other day I filled up my car at Sam's Club, and I think I paid $1.83 a gallon. It's been a long time since I've bought gas that cheap, and that puts consumers in a happy mood. But these lower oil prices also have repercussions. Today, oil closed below $50 a barrel. That's West Texas Intermediate. I think that's the lowest the price has been in 5.5 or 6 years. While that's not only good for consumers and for companies and countries that are large energy consumers, it's bad for companies and countries that are energy producers. For example, the OPEC countries, countries like Russia, and then of course, multinational companies like ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, British Petroleum. So these lower energy prices are causing fear in the financial markets, and it's really for 2 or 3 reasons. The first reason is there's the fear of earnings. Obviously, the companies that are involved in the exploration of oil, the drilling, the processing, all that, these energy producing companies like ExxonMobil, they're going to make less money. Even if they operate under the same margins, it's just going to result in lower profits, right? Just say they were getting a 5% profit margin. Well, 5% of $100 barrel oil is a much larger profit margin than 5% of $50 oil. So that's a concern. And the energy sector has been a bright shining spot in the U.S. market for the last probably 6 or 7 years, at least the last 5 for sure. So that's where a lot of the jobs growth have come from. That's where a lot of earnings have been generated. I believe it's the only industry where we've really seen any capital investment and reinvestment. And so that was really a driving force, particularly again, these last 3 or 4 years. Well, all that's going to probably evaporate and dry up right now. So the question is, will the lowering of profits in the energy sector be offset by the raising of profits in more consumer-oriented companies? Well, most likely, it probably will be offset. Lower energy prices are ultimately a good thing for the economy. But you have to remember, there's always bumps along the way. There's always rotations. As we've just discussed, what's good for one industry may be bad for another. And so that causes fluctuations in the market. That's what we're seeing right now. So one, it's those concerns about profits. The other item is concern about debt. You see a lot of these companies, particularly the smaller wildcat companies, the companies that have been drilling using more untraditional methods, where they're using fracking and horizontal drilling, and they're drilling in oil fields where the oil is called what is called tight. It's held in there tightly in shale, in these shale oil formations. Things like that, things like the tar sands up in Canada, these areas have been producing a lot of oil. However, it's come at a price. It's been very expensive. There's been a lot of investment in terms of not only people and drilling equipment, but also things like infrastructure. And we know in our society, no one uses cash for things. So all that investment has come with debt. And these companies, many of them very small, have a lot of debt. So the concern is that we may have defaults. And that will really have an impact on the junk bond market, what we call the high yields. If you're in a high yield bond fund, you need to really think of that in terms of that being a junk bond fund. And in recent years, those funds have paid nice dividends and they've had very low default rates. But that could all change if these small oil and energy companies start defaulting and going bankrupt. And remember, that has a spillover effect. If there are layoffs in the oil fields, that means the people that labor out in those fields are also getting laid off and getting fired. They can't pay their rent, they can't pay their mortgage, they miss a car payment, they're not spending as much in the local stores, so the local economy suffers. So again, this could be a regional problem. It could have a contagion. It could not only spread from these small energy companies, but then also into these small regions of the country. These regions in particular, which again have really led this recovery in jobs, places like North Dakota, West Texas, Western Pennsylvania, these bright shining spots in the economy could all of a sudden turn into a millstone. So that's a concern. And then remember, we're talking about that on a micro level. Think of that in macro terms. Don't think about just these little insolvent energy companies, but look on the world stage. Relate that now to insolvent energy producing countries, Nigeria, Argentina. And this is not going to impact just small countries. Obviously, Russia's having a credit currency problem right now, but it's also spilling over. You're seeing many of the Scandinavian countries that produce oil up in the North Atlantic. They're having to reevaluate their currencies as well. This could be a major global problem if it gets out of hand. Now, I'm not being all gloom and doom here. I don't know. I have no idea if it's going to get out of hand. But this is something I'm aware of, and this is something that I've been concerned with, and that's why I've been very cautious with my investing in the markets over the last month or so. The other problem with the low energy prices isn't directly related to these oil companies at all. It's really talking about the overall health of the economy. Now, we know that a lot of the reason that oil prices have plummeted is because of oversupply, and that's because these marginal oil producers, the companies that are producing in areas like Bakken, where they're drilling this shale oil, they've really stepped up their game. They've gone to areas that traditionally didn't have oil, and now they're pumping it from there. And this has also reinvigorated some of the older oil wells in places like West Texas. So over the last 4 or 5 years, the U.S. has nearly doubled its oil production. And we haven't doubled it, but we've come awful close. We're producing something like 10 or 11 million barrels of oil a day. That makes us the number one producer in the world. You can forget about all those things you heard about peak oil. That was really a hoax. You were misled. There's plenty of oil reserves out there. It's just a matter of if we're willing to take on the financial cost and the environmental cost to go produce it. But it's there. It's in the ground. We can definitely get it out if we want it. And that's what we've seen taking place over this last decade or so. But right now, that's not the only thing that's driving the oversupply. See, the other item is, and this is where the problem comes in, we're seeing a global slowdown. Europe is in deflation and recession. China's growth has slowed down from well into the double digits to arguably being somewhere below 7%. There's some real thoughts and concerns that the growth in China might be only 3 or 4%, which would make it only a little bit better than the U.S. I mean, think about that. That powerhouse of a billion and a half people growing at maybe a third or 25% of what they had been growing for the last 20 years. That has a major impact, not only on oil prices, but on overall commodity prices. And all those are in the toilet right now as well. And low energy costs are only going to mean that commodity prices are going to go lower, because the number one cost to extracting natural resources are the energy that goes into it. So if energy costs are going down, that means input costs will go down. And regardless of demand, commodity prices will go cheaper. And again, that's a contagion that just creates a downward spiral of global commodity prices. So these so-called emerging markets, they really are just large commodity exporters. Places like Brazil, for example, or even more developed nations like Australia, they're going to experience deflation. Their commodities are going to sell for less. Their currencies are going to have to be reevaluated downward. And then it comes back to that debt and insolvency. But because of these countries have grown and prospered with higher commodity prices, you know that they didn't reinvest that capital. You know that they didn't put that capital to good work. They squandered it. They spent it. All the infrastructure, all the social improvements, it's all been done with debt. None of it was paid for with cash. And so as commodity prices plummet, will we see these emerging countries and companies in those emerging countries, will we see them default on their loans? If that happens, that could lead to a financial crisis. And that's what Wall Street's worried about. Now, as I said at the beginning of this episode, I can't predict the future. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't know what's going to happen next month. But I know that these are short-term trends that are affecting the market right now. The smart guys on Wall Street are worried about it. And as I read the tea leaves, what I see short-term and what I'll be reacting to in the coming days and weeks are what I see in the charts. I see the 10-year Treasury hovering at just about 2%. Today it closed at 2.04%. That's the lowest it's been since around mid-2012. That's when the Federal Reserve came in to prop up the economy with quantitative easing 3. They reassured the markets that everything would be all right, that they'd print all the money they'd have to. And so consequently, here we are in 2015 with about $4.5 trillion on the Federal Reserve balance sheet, which is pretty much the market capitalization value of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That's the 30 blue chip stocks in America. That's the kind of printing and debt that we had to take on to pull ourselves out of this recession that started in 2008. And during all that gloom and doom and recovery, the lowest we saw treasuries get were in the year 2012. And like I said, we're almost back to those levels now. We're still a little bit above them. I think they went down to 1.9 or so, and right now we're at like 2.04. But you have to ask yourself, if the U.S. economy and the global economy overall are in such good shape, why are we seeing these historically abnormal low interest rates? Especially after we've seen the Federal Reserve this past October, where they cut off their quantitative easing. Now we know they're still playing monkey games with all that money on their balance sheet, but still, the official program has ended. Supposedly everybody's waiting for yields to go up as they normalize, and they should be somewhere in the neighborhood of probably 4-5%. And I say that based on sound economic reasoning. When you look at the nominal growth of GDP, there's no argument that if those numbers are accurate, we should be somewhere in the 5% range for 10-year treasuries. Now that's a rate that's much lower than what many of you would remember going back to the 80s. But really, when you go back to the 60s and beyond, that's about where the 10-year treasury hovered, around 4%. Well, we're half that right now. So if we're in such a recovery, and if the economy is so good, particularly in the United States, why are treasuries at least half of where they should be? Now, don't write in and tell me the answer. I'm just asking that rhetorically. And I ask that question rhetorically because with most things in investing, it really doesn't matter why. The why isn't as important as the outcome. What these low treasury rates tell us are that people with money, and there's vastly more money that's tied up in the bond market than that's in the stock market. And I think it's a 5-6-1 ratio. There's much more money tied up in bonds than in equities. Well, why are all the smart guys that control that money, why are they investing in 10-year treasuries when the rate is so low? Well, to me, the answer is obvious. This is fear. This is driven by fear. This is driven by uncertainty. And so what you should be asking yourself as an individual investor, what you should be saying is, hey, if all these smart guys on Wall Street, if all these smart guys in the financial markets, if they're currently concerned about investing in the stock market, if they're currently right now concerned about investing in equities, and they're putting all their money into these very low-yielding government bonds, well, if they're afraid to invest in the stock market, if they're taking their money off the table right now, maybe I should be too. Now, as you know in this podcast, I can't give you advice. I don't offer recommendations. I just want you to think. And even if you don't make your own investment decisions for yourself, you should at least be aware of what's going on, and you should be conscious of sound investment principles. So when you see the talking heads on TV right now, and they're telling you that the market's at all-time highs, and you should be buying, and you should be investing in Chinese internet stocks and all these things, well, my only advice to you would be to consider where these low interest rates are. And the rates I'm talking about now are in the U.S. They're even lower. They're even half of what ours are when you get into Germany and France and Europe. So again, to me, that means there's problems out there. I'm not telling you not to invest in equities right now. I'm just telling you to be careful. Now, there's been a lot of money made in the last 3 years or so buying on the dips. We haven't seen a real correction since 2011. Just here in mid-December, we saw the market correct only 5%. I mean, that's just a little step back. In October, we saw the market go down about 10%, but to see a real 15, 20, 30% correction, and such corrections are not anomalies. I mean, they come regularly in a healthy market. You expect to see that business cycle boom and bust in a healthy stock market. Well, we haven't seen that since 2011, which incidentally, as I mentioned earlier, has to do with that third round of quantitative easing, which started in 2012. That's what's driven and buoyed up these all-time highs in the equity markets. I'm not saying the party's over. I'm not preaching gloom and doom. But again, what I am saying is be careful. I personally will be watching for the market to stabilize. I do want to buy in the dips so I can make a profit as it goes back up. Ultimately, I do think the U.S. economy is sound. I think our markets are very resilient. And if you bury your head in the sand, you're only going to miss opportunities. But again, I do want you to proceed with caution. Be very cautious buying on a dip, particularly when it's only 5%, like we saw just 4 weeks ago. We saw how short-lived that rally was. Now again, can the market bounce back up tomorrow? Absolutely. I have no way of knowing. But I'm not getting back in that early. I always like to draw the analogy of thin ice. When I see people out there ice fishing on the lake, I don't go out there unless I know the ice is thick enough to support my weight. So I wait to see some big old fat guy go out there, maybe drive out his snow machine or take his pickup truck out there in the ice before I go out. Well, I draw that same analogy with the stock market. As I mentioned, today we saw the S&P 500 plunge almost 2%. I think it was 1.8 something. I don't have the final volume numbers in, so I know that it's been more than in these previous days, but because we've been in holiday trading, that hasn't been much, so I don't know if this was a crushing blow that came in really, you know, ground-shaking volume or not. I'm not sure if it was above average or how high above average this trading might have been. But there's no doubt that the markets are very volatile right now, and I don't see a whole lot of support levels. As I look at a chart of the S&P 500, where the market closed today at about 2020, I think today's downtrend might be just a little bump in the road. As long as the S&P can stay above 2016, I think there's clearly a support level right around that, you know, 2015, 2016, 2017 level. So we still have some give there. But, and this is where I want to caution, if you see the S&P break below 2016, then in my opinion, there's only really one more stop level where we'll see support, and that's 1972. And so if it breaks below that, you know, 1975 to 1970 level, if it breaks somewhere below that trading range, then I don't see any support until we hit the 200-day moving average, which is right around 1955. So right now, with the market closing right around 2020, we've seen the S&P 500 pull back almost 3.5% from the high that it hit just a week or so ago. If it drops down to that 200-day moving average, we'll see close to a 7% correction. Now again, in historic terms, this is mild. A 10% swing in the market is nothing to be alarmed about. So we're not looking at gloom and doom here. But again, you want to be cautious when you're buying on that dip. You want to make sure that market at least appears to have stabilized, because a 7% drop can turn into a 10% drop, and a 10% drop can turn into a 15 or a 20% drawdown. That's what you want to be cautious of. You've worked hard for your money. You don't want to see your nest egg get evaporated during a pullback when the market's coming off of all-time highs. Well, I'll be watching to see what happens this week. I'll be watching to see if things stabilize or if they get worse. I won't plan to do any in-depth market commentary until at least the end of the week, because I think we'll need at least that long to see how things play out. But I do plan on having episodes every day this week. I do need to get caught up on answering some listener questions and some special topics that are carried over from last year. So I do plan on having episodes Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday this week, and for sure on Friday we'll be back with a market review. As always, if you have questions or concerns or comments, you can get in touch with me through the website at wealthsteading.com. I appreciate those of you that have gone out and made an effort to rate and review the show at iTunes, and those of you that have subscribed at iTunes, thank you so much. That helps drive our ratings. I really rely on you telling your friends and family about this podcast and helping me spread the message about wealthsteading, wealth building principles. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, this is John Pugliano wishing you the very best of returns.